Welcome to Flip the Library, the Gwinnett County Public Library podcast. My name is Steve Thomas. I am the branch manager at the Collins Hill branch.
And I'm Melissa Grimaud, the manager at the Snellville branch. Today we are here with Jenny Lajeunesse, the technical services manager. Jenny, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you so much.
So we'll get right into it. You've been the technical services manager for almost 3 years now. Can you explain the services and that you and your department are responsible for?
I would love to. Thank you for asking. The technical services department is also known as the materials department, as y'all know, at GCPL. And our department is responsible for selecting, purchasing, receiving, cataloging, processing, and sending out to the branches all of our new print materials, especially books that you'll find. We're also responsible for ordering and troubleshooting the various subscriptions, such as magazines and newspapers that you guys get at the branch. And I don't want to leave out our electronic resources. If you visit the website at gwinnettpl.org and click on digital resources, you'll see a ton of resources. We also select and purchase all of the ones that are not Galileo resources.
Thank you, Jenny. I know that's a lot. And just for the new staff members who are new to libraries, what are some other names that the technical services department may be called in case they seem unfamiliar with that?
Sure, of course. At other institutions, it might be called the cataloging department, the collection development department, in addition to technical services. And I also want to make a note for anyone new to libraries that technical services does not mean IT. Those are two way different things in libraries. And this is the way I think of it. I think of it as a traditional name that departments such as ours are called. And it goes back to when the physical card catalog was technology. So I think that's why we're called technical services. That's my own myth I'm supporting in my own head anyway.
Do you miss the old card catalog, Jenny?
Oh, I admit that my high school yearbook had me a candid photo of me digging through the card catalog in the high school library. Media centers were not invented back then. So yes, I miss it. I miss the feel of it and being able to find the card and have that physical understanding of what all those access points were. But you know what? We've evolved, and I'm happy about that too.
It's funny to think about it back then that there's like the three separate card catalogs. You got the one that's by subject, the one by author, the one by title. the thing that I usually miss of the old days is the date due cards is what I always like. So I like looking back to see how far back somebody had checked that book out. And so it was so cool. Like somebody back in the 60s to check this out. That's how long they've had this book.
I know it is interesting. It is interesting to look at those dates. And I think many of us feel a little bit of nostalgia for that, even if some of us are of a different generation and may not have experienced those things in our books, in our hands.
I still remember those. I think I was the last of the millennials who got to see date due cards.
Yeah.
So for staff who don't know much about what the kind of stuff that you guys do, can you talk about how you go about selecting materials, like what kind of resources you use to find what you want to buy for the library?
Yeah, absolutely. So you guys hear me talk about people called the selectors with a capital S, and they have the actually pretty glamorous job of selecting library materials for GCPL. I think they do a great job. They order materials for us as a popular materials library, which, you know, we always want to have those best sellers before the street date. We want to have a robust children's collection because, you know, that circulates a lot as well. We want to have updated nonfiction that's new and try to get those exciting titles that people want and that they're putting holds on. And the way they do that, well, a lot goes into it, of course. These are experienced professionals, and they use the review sources such as School Library Journal, Library Journal Booklist, Publishers Weekly, and other sources as well. They also pay attention to book buzz out in the world. So if something gets a lot of attention on NPR, then they're going to know about it. And they'll adjust their purchasing as necessary. They also look at holds in the catalog. So we do a lot of demand-driven collection development as well. You've probably noticed that we have records in the catalog for you staff members and for customers to find well in advance of the publication date. And that's so that you can place your holds and we can see, oh, I was going to get two copies of this, but it looks like we're going to need four copies or however many in order to support the demand that we're experiencing for this title. So there are a lot of factors that go into it, and they have formulas and SQL scripts and ratios that they use. And it may be different depending on collection. It may be different depending on if we're living through a pandemic. It may be different as they make budget adjustments as well.
Your department is unique because you work from HQ, but are a major part of everyday branch activities, like you talked about. Can you talk about some of the positives and the challenges with that arrangement? And now, of course, you work from home too. So that makes your situation even more complicated.
It does. And I think I would like to talk about it in the context of the past 12 months. Normally, working at HQ never presents a problem. We do centralized collection development, weeding, cataloging, processing, and our couriers go out and do a really great job of delivering things to the branches and bringing us things from the branches. We also normally have the opportunity to go in person to the branches, and it's okay. In a normal context. But in the past 12 months, of course, you haven't seen me in your branches. I want to come real bad, but we're trying to limit our contact with each other. And so we've been staying at headquarters and we've been trying to balance our work from home schedules to maintain as much distance from each other as we can. And at the branches, I know it's no different It probably is very different, but it's not different in that as we're all working from different places and we're all doing our jobs, we face the challenge of just not being in the same room together. So we can't get those important cues of, okay, I did my part of this process. I did my part of this job. And now I know I did it and it was good because someone else takes that ball and does the next step. We're so disjointed that we never get that kind of feedback to know that, okay, my job is finished. So everything we do seems like it's ongoing and never finished, when really the books are still going to the branches. We're still doing all of the steps. We're just not doing it together. And it is making it more difficult. I'm sure this is an experience that everyone in the branch feels. I feel like people are nodding their heads right now.
So how can branch staff help you and your department? I mean, you talked a little bit about how you can help us. What's the best way, like, for instance, that staff can suggest titles for purchase or anything else like that?
Well, for now, our suggestion for purchase form is down, and it's just the ILL form. That was just a result of some budget cuts we had last year. I hope that we can get that back up and running at some point, and people have just been emailing me if they hear about something on NPR and they think, I wonder if collection development already knows about this, they can send me a message and that's fine. I might say, yep, we're on it. We knew about that one, but there's no harm in letting me know, of course. Other things that people can do are just to stick to the discard procedures, stick to the book reselling procedures that we've gone over, and just keep all that stuff predictable for us and for each other. That way we don't end up shooting little things, more little things than we already do troubleshoot, such as when people put in tickets about call numbers that we need to fix, or items that fell apart before circulating too many times. All of those are absolute legitimate reasons to put in a materials ticket. And we do appreciate when people put in materials tickets. And we find it extremely helpful when they put the item barcode or something in those tickets. So just getting down to the real specific things that are helpful. If we need to fix something, let us know exactly what it is so that we can look it up on our end. Because again, we're not in the branch to physically handle those materials with you.
I know another way a lot of times that staff can be on these teams that the system puts together, like the African American Task Force and the LGBTQ Task Force, and they were able to make suggestions for the collection happily back when we had some money to purchase those items to diversify the collection as well.
Yeah, that worked out great. And when people are participating in those teams, we get the final recommendations and things like that. And the reason that is so helpful is that those are actionable items that we can just take and use.
So I know quite a few staff members also use the can't find it form. Is that still okay? Or would you like staff to email you directly?
For now, you guys can email me if you have suggestions or you want us to look at something, and we'll be happy to. I'll be happy to. The can't find it form is right now just serving as an ILL form. So if you don't want us to go borrow the item from another library, then you might just let me know to look at something. And I can let you know if we're already ordering it. So, you know, when you ask me about books that you'd like to suggest, sometimes I let people know we're already ordering it. The publication date is in 2 months. Or I might let people know we've actually decided against that title because it's more academic in nature. A lot of the suggestions that we get just are a little bit out of scope for a popular materials library. And that's what we get the most mileage out of. So that's what we spend our money on. But there's nothing wrong with asking. The worst thing I can say is, sorry, we can't get that.
Can you talk about what an opening day collection is and how it differs from the regular collection and kind of how we're implementing it here?
Sure. It's a process that just in our current situation seems to be a little bit more in flux than previous opening day collections that were not being purchased during a pandemic. but sure, I would love to share a few things. Our Duluth opening day collection is the one that we are just hot and heavy into right now. I think that about 90% of a $430,000 budget has been encumbered. So that's good news. It might be more if I checked right now, because this is, of course, the middle of a work day. And and I know that the selectors are placing orders right now because I get notifications that I can see. The opening day collection is different from the what we call the ongoing collection that you have in your branch right now, in that it's shiny brand new books to go in a shiny brand new branch. You may ask, what about some of those a little bit older books? We're not throwing those out, are we? No, we bring a little bit of a legacy collection over into a new branch, especially if it's a replacement branch such as Duluth and Norcross. So we have access to that collection. Based on my calculations, about 30% of the existing collection at Duluth, for instance, will fit along with the amount of books that we're budgeted for to buy new. So we will be bringing that over. And the reason I think that's a good thing is that we'll have that depth to the collection. We won't be getting rid of it. Be aware that some of the items in Duluth will need to be redistributed to other branches. So I hope that we get a little bit more circulation now that we're open to the public, and that frees up a little bit of shelf space at other branches. While we are trying to weed and get some of that older stuff out of there that maybe we've been reluctant to get rid of over the past year as we had a little bit of a budget challenge, there's still going to be stuff left there on the shelf at that particular branch, which is a high volume branch, and they get a ton of returns that go to the shelf. For opening day collections, traditionally, we have made the new items at that branch non-holdable or non-floating or some combination for a certain amount of time. I'm not sure if it was 6 months in the past or if it was a shorter amount of time, but in the current ODCs, we're probably going to make that shorter just because after a slimmer budget year, we want to be able to get those materials out to the rest of the system as much as possible and just get our money's worth out of circulating those materials at other branches as well. And I have no doubt that plenty of things will again land on the shelf at Duluth because it's a high volume branch with lots of returns.
Because Duluth and Norcross are such diverse branches and have very distinctive communities, are those new opening day collections going to reflect some of that? Because Norcross is one of the branches with the Spanish collection. And Duluth, we don't have an Asian language collection, but I know that there were talks. Oh, is that happening?
Yes. So since both Duluth and Norcross do serve some of the most diverse populations in Gwinnett, we are not only updating the Spanish collections at both of those branches, we're also going to institute collections in Chinese, Korean, and Vietnamese.
That's wonderful. Very excited to hear that.
I'm excited, and I'm talking about for adults and children.
Oh, wow. Yeah, the adults is a big one.
Yeah, and it may not be, they may not be huge collections. As I look at the floor plan for the branch and see how many shelves there are, that's a lot to cram in there, and we don't want to make it too crowded. You know, we still want to have that nice, breathable, 25% of shelf space wiggle room, you know. So, but we are committing to some of those language collections. Exciting.
Is it difficult to find materials in those languages? I know Spanish is pretty easy to get in the U.S., but I didn't know if it's harder to get, like if there's people who are actually publishing those materials. Like obviously there's a billion people in China. So in China, there's plenty of Chinese books, but are they available here in the U.S. easily?
Public libraries typically work through vendors who have contacts in those countries where the languages are primarily spoken. So I just go through a vendor who can give me a list of books in Vietnamese, Korean, Mandarin, to let me know here are the choices. Here are the BISAC categories of those, which pretty loosely correspond to our findability headings. So we have that in order to just do collection development on those. If that makes sense. And then we just go from there, we purchase the budgeted amount. And fortunately, they come from a vendor who also creates and enhances OCLC bib records. What that means in normal person speak is that we don't have to learn how to catalog in languages we don't speak in the cataloging department. It's already done. We like to sometimes bounce things off of GCPL staff members with language skills to just say, does this call number sound right? Or could you take a look at this bib record and make sure we didn't mangle a summary or something like that? And that's helpful as well. It's another way that we just sort of crowdsource some of our tasks.
Well, I mean, sometimes it's as simple as, for a long time, I know people were categorizing, I guess, using OCLC or LC, a lot of cultures put the surname first instead of last, but they were still just putting the second name first because that's how it works, right? But it wasn't thinking of how that language actually works.
Right. And so right now we've gone back to how the language actually works. Our department has, you know, gone back and forth, and sometimes it depended on, does everybody here understand how this name is structured. But you know, we get help desk tickets either way, so we might as well do it correctly. And we also want to call people what they want to be called. We also want to respect people's language and culture. So it's just a small way to do that.
Can you talk a little bit about doing collection development in the middle of a pandemic?
Of course. When the pandemic started, we just kind of pumped the brakes on purchasing because we couldn't be there to receive the physical materials. I mean, our business services department could be around and could take those deliveries, you know, for what was still trickling in. Since we order things 2 months out, you know, you've got a good 2 months worth of stuff still coming in at the previous rate before we close down. And during the closure, we ended up having to take some money away from the materials budget. We are not the only library that did that. As I talked with all of my vendors and booksellers, they were hearing the same thing from librarians across the country. So none of this is unique to Gwinnett. I love to think that we're special, but everyone was in the same situation. We basically had to stop our orders, cancel many orders, and reduce what we were buying by a big percentage. And that meant doing kind of reverse collection development in a lot of ways. And it gave us an opportunity to evaluate what we needed to collect during a pandemic. Now, that didn't affect things like, should we still buy mysteries? Of course we should still buy mysteries. Do we still want ABC first readers? Yes, those circulate like gangbusters, you've noticed. But we took a little bit longer look at nonfiction. We had some discussions about, okay, with limited funds and a world in a pandemic, do we really need to buy travel books, for instance? Nope, I don't think we do. I don't think anyone's, I hope no one's going on a cruise right now. And that's just an example of some of the things that became a little less relevant in the past year, while other things became more relevant. We really wanted to purchase things like how to be happy in your job, how to cope with changes at work, how to find a job, how to master the tests that you might be taking during the pandemic as you did some self-improvement and education, hopefully on Gale courses and other electronic resources. There were a number of topics that we wanted to keep up on.
Yeah. And like working from home, I mean, just setting up home offices and things like that. I mean, people were not used to all this stuff before.
No, I definitely wasn't. I'm not sure I've made that graceful of a transition myself. I didn't know how bad I wanted to be at HQ.
I personally think you have one of the most interesting, positions. So if there's anyone out there who also thinks technical services or collection development is an interesting field, what advice would you give them?
Well, one thing we haven't talked about a lot today is cataloging. One of the other big parts of the technical services department. And I think that learning the MARC format, learning about the differences between a bib record and an item record, learning about how all of that stuff behaves in the database and how, this is real important to me, and how all that stuff affects customer behavior and how they interact with the catalog, the database, the bibs, the items, the physical materials, and just having that little universe of knowledge is what's going to help you if you are a library brother or sister interested in technical services. That is a good place to start. That's what I encourage people to do. And you can learn about the fascinating world of the MARC format by visiting the OCLC Bib Formats and Standards website. It just tells you what all the MARC formats are, what the subfields are, and when you're allowed to use them. It's fascinating. And it's been a while since I was a cataloger every single day in my professional life, but I still know enough about the MARC format to be really fun at parties.
And I found it like when I was in library school and taking my cataloging class, I was like, yeah, whatever. I know I have to do this. It's a requirement, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, this is never going to be useful to me because I'm not going to be a cataloger. That's not my thing. But I do. It is helpful just to know how to just to find information by knowing how things are broken down and know where to find things in a record and understanding what a LC subject heading is. And maybe they don't use what kind of word they use. You know, just recently they got rid of whatever cookery or whatever that was. I mean, but you had to know that before to find cookbooks.
That's absolutely true. You did have to know all the nuances of that controlled vocabulary. Fortunately, our cataloging team is good at cross-referencing terms like that in the authority file so that if we did still have to suffer through cookery as an LC subject heading, you could still type in cooking and it would say, see cookery, and you click on it and go to all the cookery and it's not that bad. But yeah, they also changed swine to pigs, didn't they? Thank goodness.
Well, and when we had the LGBTQ team on the podcast a while back, they talked about where they did a lot of catalog enhancement there too to find terminology that's not part of official LC, but things that people are going to search on.
That's entirely true. And they did a great job of adding tags in BiblioCommons. I think that they may be a little more difficult to search now than they were at the outset of that. And what we did as we learned in the materials department about how staff and customers were interacting with the catalog is that we added an additional access point. We added a local subject heading for LGBT to the items that we could find with all the different subject searches that were, we thought, related. And there were tons. You know, I didn't know. I have been doing this for a couple decades, actually, but I didn't necessarily know that I needed to type in children of gay parents to find a book about children who live with gay parents. I just didn't know. And so using that LGBT subject heading, I think helped a lot.
Well, the findability project was obviously something big a couple of years back. Can you talk about how that project kind of came to be and how you, I know it wasn't just you, but how your department and worked with the rest of the system to make that work and how you feel like it's going?
Thank you for asking about findability. There have been so many other projects since then that one seems to have faded to the back of my mind, even though we're still doing some pieces and parts of it. So our department in materials, as well as the findability team that you guys know about, has been working on this since 2019. GCPL had this idea long before I came here as the technical services manager. I wasn't here for very long before the team was developed and I got to be on it, of course. And we began working on the findability project in 2019. The team developed some headings that we wanted to use that you now see. And the cataloging team started working in October of 2019 to literally recatalog every nonfiction bibliographic record and also recatalog all the item records, because that's of course where our spine labels come from and what that has to correspond to. So we did a lot. We were able to do it, a lot of it, in batches, which means that we didn't have to open up each of, you know, how many thousands of bib records to manually edit them. Instead, we were able to take what we refer to as Dewey decades. You have the 10 range, the 120s range, and like that. So we gathered those together in Polaris in groups, and we looked at things that, as far as we could tell by looking at the titles, were alike. And we put those in a smaller group and we just edited those all together. And that was how we mowed through the nonfiction collection. And we, during that process, we knew sometimes these headings change. We'll have to go back and re-edit some of these. We also knew that, all right, we're having to meet a deadline and we want this work to be good. So we're going to make our best educated guess on what this book is about and what section it belongs in. And we'll just have to know that people are going to put in tickets later on. And we're going to absolutely be open to the fact that they're right and we weren't. So, and I think everyone knows that because we had plenty of help desk tickets to say, I think this needs to be in a different category. And that was fine. We just kind of got together and talked about it and said, you know, this doesn't mean people think that we're wrong and we did it bad. It just means that the branch staff are the ones who are putting their hands on these items, shelving them, helping customers find them. And we should probably believe them if they're suggesting a different category. And so a lot of those we did move. And some of them we went back and explained, we don't want to move this one because this is why we place things in certain categories to have them on the shelf with this. Even if it looks weird in one branch in the overall system, it fits. And we have to keep it that way because of course it's going to float to a different branch and it might fit in a different category better. But we did take more suggestions from staff, far more suggestions we actually acted on than we didn't.
Yeah, because that like you said, you kind of just brute forced the whole thing and looked by title kind of a lot of times and didn't know what the content of that book maybe was. And whereas a staff member can look at it and say, even from the cover, but like you guys weren't looking at covers, you were looking at titles and records. And
right, because we were using Polaris Staff Client, which is not that beautiful. We weren't looking at BiblioCommons or even Leap, where you see the covers. If we went into the bib record, we would see the table of contents or the summary, but we still wouldn't be finished if we looked at every one of them.
Well, and that, of course, was the big project for 2020. And after that, everything was great the rest of the year. So
flawless.
So, Jenny, is there anything that you are excited about this upcoming year?
One piece of exciting news is that we may be adding Canopy to our electronic resource offerings. We'll be excited about that because it's the first time in a few years that we've gone into offering streaming video for our customers. We've had some requests for it as well as other streaming videos, but Canopy seems to be the choice that is the best replacement for hard media DVDs with our collection. Since we've traditionally collected nonfiction DVDs, there's a lot of that on Canopy. In addition to things like classic films, foreign films, there's a ton of kids content on Canopy that is controllable with parental controls so that you can lock that subscription down for your own kid to only watch the Sesame Street and the Weston Woods videos and some good content there. That is a value add, we think, to the kids' DVD collection, which of course we're continuing to purchase.
Talking about streaming, obviously there's probably no idea at this point, is things like Disney Plus and all these other services going to be complicating to collection development? Because like things like the little Baby Yoda show and the other stuff that are like exclusive to these services, what if they don't put them out on DVD? Does that mean we can never make them available to our customers?
Well, they may be outside the scope of our collection anyway. For instance, The Mandalorian, as you refer to as the Baby Yoda show, is something that is a TV series and we don't collect those anyway. And the content that is available on Canopy, for instance, much of it is available exclusively on Canopy. Not all of it. There are other ways to get that content, but it's not really a competitor with Disney Plus or Netflix or Hulu, Amazon Prime Video. All of those streaming services just offer different content, whereas Canopy is sort of the library version of that, where you can find documentaries in addition to the ones you may watch on your own streaming services. But also Canopy and other products like it are built to serve libraries so that you don't have, well, the basis is customers don't have to pay for them. We pay for them. And then people authenticate from the library's website and have access to the content instead of being a consumer-driven product where you buy your own personal subscription. And that's kind of the huge division between those two things. You can think of it like, think of it in terms of our ebook collection. We use Overdrive because you use that through the library, whereas Amazon Kindle books you get as a consumer yourself. The library is locked out of buying those for borrowing purposes.
Yes. Yeah, so basically offering it as an alternative to other things, it's not the same thing. So, I mean, maybe Mandalorian is not a good example, but you know, what if they make Descendants 4 and it's on Disney Plus only and we can't ever have it? Obviously, we would purchase that normally if it was a DVD, but.
Right. And so I think that it's not necessarily going to replace things like if Descendants 4 comes out on DVD, you're right, we'll have demand for that. We'll probably get multiple copies. But it's still just not the same thing. And it's not going to necessarily replace that kids' DVD collection. The adult DVD collection, I think it's a good replacement.
All right. Well, Jenny, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. And thank you for all of your work that you do for GCPL.
Yes, thank you sincerely, Jenny. I would have loved to go into technical services, but I think I went into library school at a rough time when they were doing the transition between, oh my gosh, it was the RF and the, I forgot, I had to learn two different systems, and I was just like, cataloging is not my friend. But I...
Well, you know, I think that cataloging is everyone's friend because we all find it so tremendously helpful.
Yes.
But I also recognize and appreciate the commitment to public service that GCPL branch staff and managers show every day.
Yes.
So you may be just where your destiny wanted you to be.
Yes, getting down and dirty in the MARC record is just, that wasn't my lane, but I respect everyone who can.
Melissa and Steve, thank you for the opportunity to talk about technical services, to talk about resources and library books. As many people know, talking about library books is my jam and one of my favorite things to do.
Yes, it was a pleasure. Thank you for carving out the time. I know you have a lot on your plate, so we really appreciate it.
Yes, thank you, Jenny.
Yes.